Welcome, Mr. Don Costa.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, I want to warn everybody in the back that I do talk soft naturally. So if you can't hear me, you're welcome to come up forward. And, just fair warning. Again, my name's Don Costa. I've been rehabbing since 2003, essentially. We're here at rehabs right now. Who here wants to rehab? And who here thinks we're crazy for doing it? Okay, fair. We're crazy for doing it. So I'm going to talk today about rehabbing from a position of power. Before I get into that, I want to tell you basically why I think the way I think and why I approach things the way I do. So just a little history on me. I started in 2003. That's kind of a lie, I guess, because I think like most of us, a few years before I actually started, I wanted to be a real estate investor, and I circled the idea of it. I drove properties. I went to courthouse, you know, steps to watch auctions. I talked to other investors, but my mindset wasn't in the right place. I was really, really scared. I didn't think I was capable of doing it. The same thing I think we all go through before we get into it. In 2003, I got married, and I was in transition. I actually owned some cell phone stores in Las Vegas for about a year. Las Vegas is a very dangerous place to live when you're a young individual. So, especially when you're living there with friends. So, I decided to sell out to my buddy and move back to California and got married. So, I was unemployed. And the woman I married, basically, I said, I'm going to go back to school. And she said, oh, hell no, you're not. She said, basically, you're going to get a job. We're going to have kids. So, I was dead set against getting a job. For those of you, how many here are just, you're an entrepreneur? That's it. Okay? You can't live in a box. You can't live by a time clock. That's like hell that no one outside of the entrepreneur space can really understand. And so there was no way I was going to get a job. So I wanted to be a real estate investor. I started looking into, I guess it's kind of a job, but I was looking into being a loan officer. I felt like it gave me some freedom, but I also thought at the time it was going to give me an understanding of the financial aspects of real estate investing. So I went on these interviews. And I was sitting across the desk from the individual who asked me, like, why I was there. And I told him straight out, I want to be a real estate investor. I don't want to work for anybody. But I want to learn the finance side of the business. And he sat back at his desk and looked at me for a minute. He said, well, why don't you go find properties, and I'll provide the money, and we'll flip them together. And so it's a funny thing. You realize now, because I didn't even know wholesaling was a thing, you realize now that you don't actually need the money. But it's a funny thing, a little switch that goes off in your head and your mindset when you realize have the money to back me to do this. And that was kind of my moment of, okay, I can go out and do this. So I got pre-foreclosure lists, and I went out and door knocked for 3 to 4 hours a day every day. I was obsessive and compulsive about it. I literally got in the car and just drove for 3 or 4 hours a day in the morning or the evening on the weekends and door knocked, and I found that I was really, really good at talking sellers into selling me properties that they were open to selling properties. So it's an interesting story because it's not all good. That very first investor, I loaded this plate with properties. He never sold them. He never got paid. So I worked for about a year, and he never sold me. One to his daughter, did one as a rental, rehabs, it took forever. And so after about a year, I wised up, and I started talking to competitors at properties, and I was really good at closing, but I didn't have money, I guess, you know, at the time. And they had money, and so I said, hey, I'm better than you at closing. You don't have the ability to do that, but you have the money. Let's partner. And so looking at my competitors' opportunities was my leg up actually getting my first check on a rehab. So it took me almost a year of being successful at getting deals before I actually was able to get an opportunity to make money. Lo and behold, that guy realized I was working with other people and decided he was going to sue me. Crazy, right? Right? So, because he was supposed to be managing all the projects I brought in. And about a year and a half, 2 years later, I won. My countersuit got $140,000 out of him because he basically screwed me over. But it was these lessons, like, you can look back at that and go, well, I had a really rough start. But that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because now someone's like, oh, I'm going to sue you. I'm like, right? So it was a really interesting start. The cool thing about it, though, is I started making a lot of money really fast once I started making money. Once I kind of got through that trial and tribulation period, I started making money really fast. And, you know, you don't come from money, you've never had money, you've never had the opportunity to have money, and you start making money real fast, what happens? It goes to your head, right? I got this attitude that everything I touch turned to gold. And I opened a real estate company, a property management company, and a finance company, and I had multiple offices and multiple agents, and decided I was going to start a sunglass line, and I opened a restaurant and nightclub, and I mean, because everything I touched turned to gold, right? This is 2003, 4, and 5, kind of like the market is right now, where anybody can make money in it, even if you didn't run a real business. So at the time, though, I thought I ran a real business. You know, contracts would come up and tell me it's going to take 2 weeks and 20 grand, it would take 3 months and $40,000. I never looked at the properties or the quality, and I would sell them, and I'd make more money than I projected, so I was a genius. Right? So how many people have felt that way before? So, lo and behold, we know what happened. 2008 came about, and it was a very slow, I tell the story sometimes as it was an awakening, and I opened, but it really was a slow, painful awakening. Because I don't think any of us really thought, did anybody go through 2008? Huh? No, anybody go through 2008? The market crash? So, I didn't think that the market was going to do what it did. I didn't think it was just going to fall out. And so, I just let myself believe in trying to keep everything alive, trying to keep all the balls in the air. So, what I didn't realize, though, at the time was I was an ineffective leader. I was running a horrible business. I wasn't leading, managing. I wasn't organized. I was a bottleneck in my organization. So when people would come to me with an idea or something, a system and process, I was the reason why it didn't get done, decisions weren't being made. And all these things that you do, and it was a giant tool because I thought I could actually hold, all these things led to a very slow and painful demise. It's like, you've done all these things? Yeah. I mean, the money was just getting sucked out of me so quickly, it was ridiculous. And I just remember thinking, you know, naively that it's not possible. I can make that ship's gold, put me in any market in the U.S., and I can make 10 grand, you know, in 30 days. I can make 50 grand in 30 days, depending on how hard I want to work, and it's really, really easy. But at that time, it wasn't. The bills started to stack up. I was going in and out of foreclosure. I had, you know, issues with the electric bill, the water bill, you name it. Each business closed at its own point. And the last thing that I had to really fight for was restaurant nightclub. We fought that open as hard as we could. So it's like, do you ever feel like you're falling this way? Yeah. Like you have no options? That's kind of where I was headed to. Mindset started to go back to being very negative. My self-talk started going back to being very negative. And I just slowly fell into this hole. How many of you guys like Taco Bell? Who hates it? Okay. Imagine it's Saturday morning. Okay, just put it here. Imagine it's Saturday morning. You've been through hell. You don't have a lot of money. You don't have any money. You look at one of your remaining credit cards you have, and it says you have $90 to go. $90. The difference between actual balance and available balance is a little bit sorted. You collect your family, and you say, let's go. Let's watch a movie. Let's get some lunch. You walk into Taco Bell. You order $20 in the family, and your card is approved. Just imagine that. You stand there, look at the kid, tell him again, grab the card again, and go to the money there. Look over at your spouse, and say, hey, Annie, you got any money? They say no. So you have to collect your family and leave Taco Bell for $20. That happened. I still have PTSD today when I'm with people and I go to give them my credit card. Like, I still get that gut punch. I was in Miami a week ago, 2 weeks ago, speaking, and I handed my card to the cashier and my card got declined because the bank thought it was fraud because I was in Miami running it out of the Star Lounge. I ran it 3 times in the same night. And even though I know I have plenty of money and half a dozen other cards and bank accounts, it still was a gut punch. Right? So, as entrepreneurs, though, in that moment, I was okay in the sense that I can take anything. How many people feel like as an entrepreneur, we're rhinos, right? We take all the arrows, right? It wasn't until I was walking out of that restaurant with my kid's hand in my hand and him asking me why the main guy wouldn't give us our food that I had the soul-crushing moment. So it's that realization that you're failing everybody around you moment. Christmas, the same year, my younger son wanted a remote control motorcycle. Toys R Us, the stores were that cheap. They were sold out everywhere. I went to a hobby shop and tried to buy the motorcycle, but the cheapest one there was almost $400. I couldn't do it. So I crossed my fingers and hoped, well, these four people would remember. And by $400 motorcycle, that was just a case. So the first thing that boy said, said that his bed was, today's the day Santa's going to bring my motorcycle. I'm so excited. He was ecstatic. He ran out of that room to the Christmas tree, and as he opened every present he had, he threw them aside, knowing that the next one was going to be his motorcycle, and I knew his motorcycle was not there. Anybody ever feel like you failed your kids? Yeah. Soul crushing. Your spouse calling you from the grocery store because their card won't clear, and they got a cart full of groceries, and they're crying on the phone, there's nothing to do about it. That was my life for a minute. And it was, I sat in a chair for about 6 months, just in my own personality. Mindset's a funny thing. Mindset will make us or break us. The most powerful thing we have is our mind. And in that moment, my mind was broken. In 2010, I actually posted this. I'm struggling to pick a path. Social media is cool because it documents everything in timestamps. So, I was lost. And the reason why was about 30 days before that, I got a $677,000 judgment against me. Restaurant, nightclub, landlord. By the time I actually came up for air and decided that I was going to put my big boy pants on and go back to work, that had ballooned to almost $1 million between the interest and transfers. Anybody ever been in a hole that big? It screws with your head. You start to say things to yourself. I'm a failure, I'm not worthy, I'm this, I'm that, I suck, should I be here? Fear, doubt, all that. You start to build your own prison around you, your own personal prison around you. And I remember sitting in that chair. I was trying to get a job. I was trying to get employed by somebody, and I had an associate's degree. So I was undereducated, because everybody back then wanted a bachelor's degree in 2010, or if they're even hiring. Or I was underqualified. They didn't want to give me a shot. Thank God they didn't, because I look back on it, but in that moment, I was in my own personal prison, and I had what I felt were no options. So, how did I pull out of it, I guess is the question everybody always asks me. And the answer is, I was talking to Vina on the radio show about this, you know, people will say, oh, you did a great job, you know, you saw this or that, and you pulled yourself out, and that's not the truth. I had no options. And I was sitting in a chair, and I was like, what can I do to get myself out of this? And the only thing that I'm really good at is I know when a deal's a deal. And I can talk somebody into selling me a property, and I can put the money together. But I was scared as hell to do it, because I thought real estate had failed me. At the time, I thought it was real estate. You look back on it now, and it was because I was just an idiot, right? But I thought it was real estate. And so I was scared. And I put this slide together because I think it's important. You can't let fear own you, because you'll literally fail everybody that matters to you if you do. And in that moment, being scared, you know, playing Russian roulette with the water bill and the light bill and the foreclosure and modifications and this and that, and I was failing everybody. I was scared. And so I opened up my laptop. I remember the moment I did it, and I placed an ad on Craigslist, and I said, you know, experienced flipper looking for private money backer must be close enough to have a cup of coffee. I got 6 phone calls from that ad. and one of the gentlemen was wanting to meet me for coffee. So, the problem is, my mindset was so weak at the time that all I did was talk to the guy, but I never closed him on giving me a deal. So, survival mode's a funny thing, and I was in survival mode. In survival mode, you're usually fighting for the little pebbles in front of you, right? The light bill, the water bill, the groceries. You're not looking at the big boulder that you can push over that's actually going to change your situation in your business. How many have been in survival mode in their business or personal life, right? All you can do is focus on right now. You can't focus on tomorrow or the next day or the path ahead. When you're driving a car, you look ahead. If you notice, you don't watch the lines in the road. You look ahead because your eyes will take you where you're going. When you're in survival mode, you're looking between the lines, right? And what happens with a car is this, and that's what happens with your life. So in order to get out of survival mode, you have to change what you're fighting for. Your battles have to be bigger than the little moments in front of you, okay? It's very important that you focus on the big things that are going to push you over that edge. So if anybody's in their business right now and they're struggling with anything, you got to know that those little fires, if you're basically a fireman, a firewoman, right? Those little fires are all distractions that are keeping you from your true purpose. And in survival mode, in fear and doubt, I sat in front of that gentleman and didn't close him on backing out of the deal. He was a talker. Okay. So, you got to change your mindset. That was the first thing I had to do. At the time, I didn't realize it. Realize that I was even doing it. But, you have to act as if. Okay? And what I mean by that is not fake it till you make it. It means actually believing that you're capable of being the individual that can have whatever it is you want to have. I had to own that I was good at the things that I was good at, and that I was going to be capable at doing this business again. I was going to be capable at building a future again. So, that is so important. And the trigger for me in that moment, the one thing that kind of clicked was when I was sitting at Starbucks for the umpteenth meeting with this guy, and he had been talking for 3 hours, and I drank a Trenta iced black tea, and I had to pee so bad, and I wasn't even going to leave that meeting because I didn't want to distract them from the conversation. I got texts from my wife that our water had been shut off. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, I either got to own this, or I just got to go back home with my tail between my legs. And I made it click. I am good at what I do. I'm going to do this, and I'm not leaving this conversation. I almost said that. Sorry. I'm not leaving this conversation until this guy tells me he's backing me on a deal. Again, I didn't even know wholesaling was a thing. I thought I had to have the money. And I got him to back me on the deal that night. He said, yes, I will do a deal with you. And again, click. I have money behind me. I am all powerful. I am going to go out and find a deal. It's a funny thing, mine, right? Okay, so you have to own your value. That was the other thing I had to learn from this. Okay, we all have value. We walk into a conversation. A lot of us will walk in with a private lender or a contractor or somebody in our life, and we'll check our value at the door because we think they're here. And that's not the case. If I'm sitting with a lender, a contractor, a banker, anybody in this room, I know that I stand on equal with you, toe-to-toe. I'm not better than you, you're not better than me. I bring something to the table, you bring something to the table. It took me a minute to realize that. But once I did, I can walk into any conversation with anybody, and if the value exchange is going to work for both of us, we're doing something. I don't sit and stammer and stutter. I don't agree to things that don't need to be agreed to. I agree to the things that are right for my business right now. And if they're right for you, then you agree too. The unfortunate mistake is that we get in our head and don't always believe that we have value. And that was one of the biggest lessons I had. I hit rock bottom. You can't take my value away now. I built back from nothing. You can't see that in the value exchange, then we're in the wrong room. You know, you're going bang on my thing. That's the end. That's fine. Does that make sense? So, today, I take this and turn it into this. We we've done upwards of 130 rehabs a year. You all pictured it? Yeah, that was a horror house. Yeah. So, I don't know if I have it on here, I may, but anyway, I host a podcast called Flip Talk. One of the biggest things that, biggest mistakes I've made in 2003, 4, and 5 was having 50,000 distractions, shiny object syndrome. Who suffers from shiny object syndrome? We all do. Come on, everybody should have a hand up. Every one of us in this room, if you're a true entrepreneur, is like, oh, squirrel, oh, squirrel, oh, squirrel. And so when I got to a point where we were doing this business and I couldn't tell you what street the properties were on because my team was handling it, I was going, okay, what do I do next? And so I launched the podcast, honestly, with the only intention of talking to really smart people and staying in my lane. So 6 years ago, I launched the podcast. It's been a fun ride. There's actually two of them. One's called Rookie Playbook, and the other one's just called Flip Talk. So I run a mastermind of incredible investors, which I just spent the last 2 days with in Nashville, and that got me there at midnight last night. So, and I have, in a 12-month period, I tend to do over $1 million in assignment fees. And wholesaling is my side fee. So that's $1,074,000 in assignment fees. Inner Circle is the mastermind community, yeah, that I run. So, yeah. That's just wholesaling. That's my side gig. So, that $1 million judgment, can I tell you a story about that $1 million judgment? I settled that thing for $24,000. And the reason I did that is because every time the guy came to me, I was like, I got no money. I got no money. And then finally, I would say, I can do 24 grand. I can do 24 grand. He'd say no. He'd say no. And then finally, I said, I would do 24 grand. He said, okay. I believe that he thought I was going to default on that. I went back to him and I said, well, I can only do it at $2,000 a month. And he said, okay. And I know, if you think how creditors think, right? They think like, okay, let me get as much out of this guy as I can. He's going to default on these payments and then I'll just start all over again. Right? Because that's usually what happens. Except I made the payments. I ran into him. He's local to my market. I ran into him in a parking lot after I did that. He called me a few choice words and told me that someday I had to make it right. But anyway, my judgment's satisfied. So I sold $1 million judgment for $20 million. Negotiating skills, right? Okay, so the reason why we're here, secrets to rehabbing from a position of power. All right? Anybody want to know my thoughts on that? I'm assuming that's why you're all in the room. How many feel like this when you're rehabbing? Throw it against the wall, see what sticks. You've had moments like this where you just feel like you've had the crap kicked out of you, right? This house, I actually wanted to bring this house up. This is a rehab we did a handful of years, many, many years ago, actually. And the reason why this house is particularly important is because at the time I got back into this, we started rehabbing a lot of properties, and I was the everything in my business again. And I was standing in front of this property. I pulled up in my truck. I was meeting the contractor to pick up paint color. And I was getting ready to cross the street, and I'm looking at this house. I was late to pick my kid up from school. I had to get back to the office to basically submit receipts for reimbursement with my lender, because if I didn't do that, I was going to be out of money. And I was 30 minutes from my office, 20 minutes from home. There was no way I was going to be able to do it all on the same day. I remember standing in front of this house looking at it. Prison. Anybody feel like that? This is a freaking prison. And that was an aha moment. I had had a friend of mine start following me on rehabs when I did my back up. I did my first deal back in the business in June 2012. I JV'd with a lender. They put up the money. I did the work. We made 20 grand on the deal. I got 10 grand and was back in the game. So. Real quick, just to kind of summarize that, we bought two properties right after that, a day apart, and then we did one, then two, then three. By June of 2013, I had 400 grand in the bank. So I went from broke to 400 grand in the bank. I had a buddy follow me on projects, but I hadn't turned him over to him. He had watched everything I'd done. He had helped me. He had started kind of managing them for me. but I hadn't let go yet. Who feels like they can't let go in their business because they're the only one that can do it all, right? That is a disease, okay? It is a sickness that we all suffer from as entrepreneurs because we're the best, right? It's amazing how these multi-million dollar companies, these corporations, make billions of dollars a year without us, but we're the best, right? So that was my aha moment, that I needed to let people that are going to be better than me at anything get out of their way and let them do it. And so I started turning projects over to Luke, and I basically had him follow me early on, and then I followed him on a handful, and then I said, call me if you have questions, and then I finally said, don't call me anymore. You got this. And I trusted people. That was the scariest thing I ever did in my life. Yeah. I didn't. That is a fact. Well, actually, let me take that back. The first couple projects I didn't, and then I paid him $2,000 a month. So I started to. So I can't say forever I didn't, but I didn't at first. Okay, so how did I do that? How did I get him to work for nothing for a little bit, and then take a little bit, and then finally take more? And just so you know, a few years back for Christmas, I bought him a brand new car. Here's a deep venture. So it's not like I don't take care of him now. A lot of people, when you're in situations and you're not sure if you have the money to pay somebody, you sit down with them and you sell the vision. I sat down with them early on. I said, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to build. This is what it's going to be. And he said, I want to be a part of that. I want to see what you do. And he followed me on his own. And then when I could give him something, I gave him something. And I let him know, when I can give you more, I'll give you more. And when I can give him more, I did. So, but we get in our head when we're trying to build a team that, you know, they're going to want too much money, or they're going to want this, or they're going to want that. Some people just want to be along for the ride. Sit down and sell your vision when you're trying to build a team and see who wants to go with you. Okay? Some people will, some people won't. Ask them what they need. Some people aren't motivated by money. Oh, I can't hire a project manager because they're going to want $60,000 a year, or $75,000 a year, $100,000 a year. You sit down and you talk to them, you say, hey, what do you want to get out of this position? Oh, I want to make $40,000. I'm thinking you want 60, right? We get in our own head and we make decisions, assumptions, right? What does assumptions do? When I say the word, makes an ass out of you and me. So we make assumptions and we assume the result, and we never really ask the question. Again, that's a disease. Okay? Yeah. Never. Fantastic question. And you guys are welcome to ask questions. Was my wife on board? And the answer is no. Well, so the very first round, she was kicking and screaming the entire time. Like, she was not on board. Didn't matter how much money I made. I made stupid money. And she would spend it. She happily spent it. But she was never on board. It was always, get a real job. This is not real. This is not real. The second time around, she was a little more on board, in the sense that it was like accepting that this is what I'm going to do, and there's no other option. But still kind of kicking and screaming, if that makes sense. So, look, I'm going to get into framing a lot in this conversation, how we frame things. What I've learned through the years is that the people around us that tell us the negative things, they have a perception, right? They have a lens that they look through. Every one of us has this lens that we see the world through. It's all based on experiences, how we're built internally, how our mind works, how many times we've been kicked when we're down, how many times we've won. It creates how we see the world. Okay? And so, and again, I'm going to talk about this a lot, because it's a lot of how you talk to people through some of the things that I've done in my business. But you got to understand that the people who are trying to protect you are seeing the world through their lens. Okay? And if you take the opportunity to see the world through their lens, have the conversation back with them. Like, I get you. I understand that you're fighting about me on this. I know why you're fighting about this. But this is important to me. And this is why it's important to me. And I'm okay with it not working out. You know, and maybe the conversation needs to vary with each person you're talking to, because some people will hear that message and some people won't. But, you know, how you communicate back is important. And a lot of times we make the mistake of communicating back through our lens. You're attacking me. Why don't you support me? You should love me. You should have my back. And so we get in this defense posture, and everybody basically, guns blazing, everybody's standing there, and nobody's ready to back down. Okay? you start to learn to communicate people with people through their lens, and sometimes understand that you got to do the frog in boiling water thing, right? You got to give it to them in little increments. Like, in my marriage situation, she's an emotional thinker. Everything she does is an emotional reaction. That's not because she's a woman. I know a lot of men that are that way. Okay? I am not. I am not an emotional, reactive person. I make decisions on fact only. Give me the facts. Give me how we're going to solve the problem. Emotion is not part of the equation. I'm also a jump off the cliff and go to the airplane on the way down kind of guy. So I'm just going to figure it out. You know, if I hit the ground on the way down because I didn't figure it out in time, I'm okay with that. Got to prove that, didn't I? So I learned that I got to take my box of information and walk over to her and set it down and walk away and not stand there for the explosion. You know what I'm saying? And because she will go through this whole, they talk about like the five stages of grief, right? She'll go through this whole phase of coming to terms with something that may take 2 hours or 2 days. And I used to drop it off and stand there for whatever the consequences were and then react to the consequences. And now I know how she operates. I walk away and 2 days later I go, okay, you cool with that? You good? And then the conversation begins. Does that make sense? So stop trying to communicate people through your lens, with people through your lens. Okay? Does that help? All right. So, my experience, okay, caused me to question everything I did. My experience through losing everything, running the company like an idiot, being a douchebag tool, thinking that everything I touched turned to gold, and then realizing that I wasn't, caused me to really question everything. Okay, what is right? What is wrong? What's the norm? Does that really work? Is there a better way? I asked a lot of questions. I asked a lot of questions this day. So, this isn't a 70, maybe you've seen a 70. This isn't a 70 reference. What's in the box? Does anybody know what's in the box here? There. Okay. What's that? I still can't hear you, I'm sorry. We all think that there's this way of doing things, right? Like this way it's always been done. Okay? What's in the box doesn't matter. The way it's always been done doesn't matter. Okay? How you borrow money, how you manage contractors, how you do this, how you do that, how you tie your shoes. How it's always been done doesn't matter. And that's the point I want to make. It's irrelevant. Because if there's a better way, there's a better way. You know, there's a time that they thought the earth was flat, right? And that was the way it was always thought, right? So the way it's always been done isn't necessarily the right way. You have to question everything. Is this the best way I can do it? One of the coolest things about running a podcast, speaking in front of people, coaching, is when somebody asks me a question, I actually stop in my head and I think, is there a better way to do this? Am I giving the best advice? Could I be telling my team or explaining to my team better? It actually causes me to think, and I love that. I'm a whiteboarder. Like somebody asks me a question, and 20 minutes later, I have this whiteboard full of crazy stuff. Because that's just, I question everything that I've got to write down. So the other thing we're going to talk about and kind of go through here is just kind of seeing things differently. And I have this side chart for a reason. It says one rarely sees what's right in front of them. Okay? And what I mean by that is a lot of us, the answer is like right here, just in our peripheral vision, basically staring at us, but we're looking the wrong direction. Again, focus on what's in the box. Okay? Or a lot of you probably know what the answer is. You just need permission to do it. Okay? And that's usually the biggest struggle, is we just need permission to do it. Okay? The other thing about how I think is path of least resistance. Okay? Path of least resistance is the most important thing to me in anything I do. If it's painful, I don't want to do it. If I feel like I'd rather drink bleach than do that task, I try to find a better way. Okay? So, the first thing that I did in my business is I set up systems. When people hear systems, how many people get overwhelmed by it? Okay, so I want to simplify it. A system is a simple process or standard designed to set an expectation and boundaries for which your team will perform within. That's it. If this, then that. Okay? So if this happens, then that happens, and it has to happen every single time. That's really all a system is. It's boundaries. A system can be as simple as Slack. Anybody here heard of Slack before? Okay. Who hasn't heard of Slack? Okay. Slack is a communication tool. We use Slack to essentially manage our projects, transaction coordinate. We open a Slack channel with the property name, and everything from information on the property, contact with the homeowner, who the escrow company is going to be, all documents, pictures, communication is in that Slack channel. Does that make sense? We cannot text, email about that property. The communication has to be in the Slack channel. That's a system. And that's a rule that everybody has to follow. And the reason why is because there was too much of, well, who approved that? Oh, what's going on here? Oh, what the hell is up with that? Why did you get this $4,000 bill from a company we never use? And nobody can answer the question. So now we have that Slack channel for that property, and you just scroll through and you can see, oh, well, so-and-so did that. It's in one spot. Make sense? That's a system. Slack? It's a platform, yeah. Like you have it on, you can have it on your phone or your PC or S-A-L-C-K, just like it sounds. S-L-A-C-K. I can't spell. See, you do not have to be smart to do this business. Sorry. Not that you all can see this, but that's the communication history on that project. Pictures, documentation. You'll have to scroll through. That's the only. You can search keywords in there, but you usually scroll through. It's really not that bad. So, as long as it's all in one spot, that's all I care about. That's my primary concern. It's a lot easier to scroll through the history on Slack than it is to find an email or text message that is in somebody else's phone that you know use, right? So that's the whole point. Yeah. No. The funny thing about contractors is a lot of them work with aren't exactly tech savvy. So that's a whole different conversation. Okay. Again, systems. The way I break it down, it's a person, it's a process, or it's a program, right? Slack is a program. It's also a process. It has to be implemented by people. So usually when you're running into a situation in your business, the answer to the question is, I got to hire. I got to put a process in place, if this, then that. Or I need some kind of software, like a CRM. That makes sense. Does that make sense, everybody? So, okay, one of the first systems you need to have in your business is your buy box, if you're going to be a rehabber. If you're going to be a rehabber, you have to know what it is you're going to do. If you're willing to rehab anything and everything, you're going to have your own personal health. Okay? How far away does the rehab need to be? Okay? How close is it? What's the largest size I'm willing to do? What's the largest price point I'm willing to do? Those things are important to determine. Okay, we'll only do first time and second time buyer price points. That's it, in any market that we're in. I'm not going to do a $500,000 property in Fresno, California, because that's a high-end property. It takes longer to rehab. You have to have special finishes, which we all know right now is hell on earth to try to get. And you have a smaller buyer pool. Okay? Less options to sell. This market right now, it doesn't hurt you that much. In other markets, it takes a little longer. Anytime something sits in my books longer than 120 days, I get really, really nervous. And high-end properties, you're usually in for about 6 months, so we don't do that. That's a system. So knowing what your buy box is important. Don't square peg round hole your ARVs, your numbers. Don't square peg round hole your rehab budget. Too many of us will see that the ARV, especially right now, the ARV says $200,000, but we know that if we wait, we bought it 3 months ago, it was $190,000, so if I buy it now, by the time I finish rehab, it'll be worth $210,000. You can't look forward in any market because that's how you get caught. Okay? okay? What you can sell it for today is the only thing that matters. You can't push that ARV. Oh, well, there's this outlier comp that somebody paid cash for because they had to have it, and it sold for $100,000 more than everything else, so I'm going to base my ARV on that. How many people have seen wholesalers do that too? Or it only take $5,000 to rehab, and a bomb went off in the kitchen. The numbers are the numbers are the numbers. And so if you want to rehab a position of power, you have to know your buy box, what you're willing to do, what you're not willing to do. You have to stick to your guns on that, and you have to live and breathe and die by what the numbers really are. The rehab is the rehab is the rehab. The ARV is the ARV. Does it make sense? How many people have tried to square peg round hole in this room once in your lives? You guys are all lying. Because I've done it, yeah. So, everybody knows what ARV is, right? After repair value? Okay, so there's no formula for that because it is what it is. You're looking at usually properties within a quarter mile that have sold in the last 6 months that are equal to or close to your subject property. Okay, that's how you determine what the after repair value is. And so you're looking at something that is going to be in the condition that you're going to sell it in. So if you're going to sell it rent ready, you're looking for rent ready condition. If you're going to sell it rehab, you're looking for rehab condition. You don't want to go further than a quarter mile unless you are in a situation where maybe you're in a rural area and you have to. You usually don't want to cross major cross streets. Those are usually your boundaries. They're important because usually a major cross street will separate, you know, a housing subdivision built in 2000 and one that was built in like 1960. And there it becomes apples and oranges for what the properties are. So as far as Mayo, though, no. Now, the rule that people talk about, the maximum allowable offer, the rule that people talk about is the 70% rule or whatever. The problem with that, it's a good rule to kind of start with if you're new. The problem with that is, like in California, people will buy 80, 85 cents on a dollar. You have some really aggressive investors. So as a wholesaler or a rehabber, you got to know that you're living and dying by 70% Mayo, and because somebody told you on a podcast to do that, but you're going to miss out on a lot of properties. You got to look. This is a business. We all want a business, right? Not a hobby. You got to learn your market. Well, you got to have somebody on your side that knows your market. I have a guy on my side that knows all of our after repair values, and then we have our formulas for how we buy. I don't buy on I need to make $30,000. I buy on cash on cash return. Okay. Does anybody know the difference? Sorry. Okay. So, Well, no. It's a percentage. So if I'm all in $100,000, if at that time I want a 15% cash on cash return, I want to make $15,000 on that property. Okay. For me, it doesn't matter if I make $7,000 or $700,000, as long as I make that 15%. There are some people that will say, I won't touch that property for less than $30,000. And they don't care if they invest $100,000 or $500,000, as long as they make $30,000. Okay? I want to make a percentage. And the reason why I want to make a percentage is when I sat down with that first investor, his whole thing was annualized cash-on-cash return. How many times can I turn that money? And so that's how I built my business. If I make 15% cash on cash and I turn that $100,000 three times in a year, I've effectively made 45% on the money. And when I talk about how I borrow, you'll see that I make an infinite return. But I want that infinite return to be as large as possible. So, you got to pick your model. Again, you got to know your buy box, you got to know what you're willing to do and not willing to do. You got to know your numbers in your market. You have to, or have somebody on your team that does that you can trust. Okay? And actually, this slide's important. Always verify, right? When I say have somebody on your team that you can trust, because the person who's wholesaling you the property, or the agent who's selling you the property, who makes a commission off of you saying yes in closing, is not the person you trust to give you your numbers. Anybody who gets paid when you do something needs to be verified. You need your own independent information. The wholesaler says the ARV is X and the rehabber is Y is not acting in your best interest. Their numbers might be 100% correct. They're not acting in your best interest. They're acting in their best interest. Right. You could, yeah, I mean, you could argue that, for and that may work for you. For me to cash out, but I don't care if I make $7,000 on a rehab. I'll be honest with you guys. I have a machine I plug stuff into. The reason why I can do 130, 140 rehabs a year, to be honest with you, is because I'm willing to make 7 or 10 on a rehab. It all about, I have base hits and home runs. Does that make sense? And so that's the reality. If you're going to do volume in any situation, you're going to run a little leaner on some things. Well, people, everything else is easy. I'm going to cover some of that in this, but I'll answer it right now. So when you hire, and I'm going to hit this again, so forgive me when I do, but when you hire, what you're looking for is teachable and coachable. Teachable and coachable. You want somebody teachable. If you don't want experience, you want teachable, coachable, loyal. That's what you want. You can teach anybody to do anything if they're teachable, coachable, and loyal, right? I mean, obviously, we all have different personalities. There are personalities that are built for admin. There are personalities that are built for project management. There are personalities that are built for acquisitions. Those are all rabbit holes we can go down. I can talk about any of them at length. But the people is your struggle. And if you're trying to hire experience, you're usually hiring somebody that has baggage. So, and then the next biggest struggle is money. How to navigate the money, especially when you're a rehabber. Okay, I'll talk about that. Okay. A system we have in our organization is our project manager has to see every property before we close on it. I had an acquisitions person that I do, this works for me for this day, he's actually dispositions now, and I do trust him, but I don't trust him with numbers. And I trust he has the best interest of the company in mind, but I don't trust his numbers. Does that make sense? So he went through a property, and he went and he said, man, this thing only needs $30,000 all day long, and I trusted his number. And we closed on it, and Lucia just walked it, and Lou's like, this is the first property I've ever seen that has plexiglass windows. Right? Yeah. So Justin didn't know to look for plexiglass windows. So anyway, the moral of the story, not that Lou was looking for them, but he was checking the windows. We spent $65,000 on it. I had somebody who was not in that seat give me numbers that they're not accustomed to giving me, and I trust them. So a system now is, if we're going to close on it, he has to put his eyes on that property when it comes up. Okay? Yes? How we find our properties? Okay, that's a rabbit hole. So direct mail, cold calling, primarily networking, buying from the wholesalers, the wholesale too. 2018 and 2019 combined, I sent out 2 million postcards. That's a whole other topic. I can go down a rabbit hole on how to track your marketing and data and analytics and stuff, because not that I'm a data geek, I'm not, I really hate it. But it's exciting when you see numbers and trends, and so I think everybody else can check the numbers. But 2 million postcards. I spent $563,000 in marketing for 1 year. So as you look at that number, you're actually about too high performance cards with that, and I spent that on paper. Let that sink in for a minute. Paper. People. Little tiny pieces of paper at that weren't even that cute. Is that delivery of paper? Yeah. No. So during that period of time, I had 8. And that's a whole, again, look, I can talk about anything in this business. I've been doing it for 20 years. I'm going to talk about marketing, hiring, acquisitions, people. I did acquisitions. I mean, I can go down any rabbit hole you want. I had 8 at the time. I have 3 now. We closed everything over the phone. We were belly to belly then. Makes sense? So we were going actually to on the appointments. Now we do everything over the phone. So now I only need 3 people to do it. I had multiple. And just to kind of hit on that, the reason why we do everything over the phone was because when I had 8 acquisitions people and I was marketing at that level, I had to market to make sure their appointment book stayed full. And there is a lag time until you see whether or not they're actually performing. They have hills and valleys. They slack off, they get on fire. And so I realized then that I need to market to the best interests and best needs of my company, and that's why I brought it all in-house and put everything in. And I have, I shouldn't for a room like this and close it over the phone. I get excited. I'm actually, I like closing over the phone. No. We haven't sent pictures, or we'll send somebody out to take pictures of the property. We always let them know that we have a whole series of questions we go through, and we always let them know that if something isn't true to what they've told us or not disclosed, we're going to have a discussion about price. You know, that's something that's a caveat we have in that conversation with them. But and if we're going to close on it, our project manager has to see it. So, you know, a lot of what we do, you know, now a large portion of our volume's upstate. So, and in that case, we can't. So, okay. All right. Hellebro, falling on a budget. How many of you feel this way or felt this way as a rehabber? All your money's in projects, right? Okay. So the next step to running rehabs with additional power is managing your money. So if you don't control your money, your money's going to control you. So I want to use a scenario here. Okay. So you buy two properties a month. Okay. Anybody has, this does not make sense to anybody. Just raise your hand and let me know. You're going to buy two properties a month. Okay. $20,000 down each property, right? Because you have to have skin in the game, right? That's the way it's always been done. Okay? Your monthly payment is $1,000 for each property. Does all make sense? So you put $40,000 down that month, you have $2,000 in payments. Your average turn time is 120 days. Let's just say your average turn time is 4 months. When you do the math, month one, you're $42,000 in. Month two, you're $86,000 in. Month three, you're $132,000 in. Month four, you're $180,000 in. So you're $180,000 out of pocket before you turn the first round of properties. How many people have been in that situation? Who's got a few hundred thousand dollars out of projects right now? Okay, who's got more than that? Okay. You can't scale a business this way. This is the way it's always done. You have to have skin in the game. Right? Outside the box. Start thinking differently. And I went through this situation and I looked at it and I'm like, I am losing sleep. This sucks. Every dollar I have come in goes right back out the door because I'm going to grow my business. I am broke all the friggin' time. I am tired of feeling like I'm broke. So what I do? I don't use hard money. I don't. I do, I'm not saying it's wrong, but I do not. Why? Because they require me to put money down. Okay? I don't use any of my money in any project, period. Hands down, my money is kryptonite. It does not go in a project at all. And I don't work with lenders that don't do 100% of my projects. When I say 100%, I mean holding costs, purchase, front costs, rehab. I don't give them points up front. If you want points, it's financed into the loan. I go to the closing table and sign the papers and walk away with the property, and I don't put a dollar. Whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. Does that make sense? The way it's always been done is you have to have skin in the game, and I am not going to do it the way it's always been done. And I had this epiphany that if I had skin in the game all the time, I was never going to have any money if I wanted to grow the company. Yeah. So how'd the conversation go? See, I got a slide for that. Because I knew that was going to be a question. It's framing, right? We talked about framing. Okay. Wow, this is taking, I got to go a little faster, guys. So, it's framing. And ultimately what it came down to was I sat down with my lender and I said, look, you think I'm a better bet if I have skin in the game. And that is not true at all in any way, shape, or form. I am a better bet if I have reserves, if I have money in the bank, if I can sleep at night. Because if I'm in a situation where I have to decide whether or not I'm paying you or feeding my kids, I'm feeding my kids. Right? Okay, if I'm in a situation where I can get more money for this property, but I'm desperate to get money back to feed my kids, I'm going to dump that property for the least possible profit just to get it off my books. And so I sat down with them and I said, I am a better bet if I have money in the bank. This way, look at what you're doing to me. You think I'm not a risk because I have skin in the game? And all you're doing is making me a liability. Okay? I just changed the conversation. This old way, liability. New way, not liability. Okay? I even went to them and hang on. I went to all my vendors. So I went to my lenders and I had the conversation. I said 100% financing period. Then I went to all of my vendors and I said, I want net 30. Flooring people, cabinet guy, not HVAC, but windows. I went to him and said, I want net 30 on terms. So even though now I'm borrowing 100% of the rehab on wood from the lender, I'm also leveraging my vendors net 30. What does that mean? Just so everybody doesn't know, I don't have to pay you for 30 days. You install it, you give me the invoice, I have 30 days to pay it. What's really cool about that is a lot of times you'll have sold the property before you actually have to pay the bill. Changes the dynamic, changes the money situation. Then I went one step further and I said to my lender, I said, well, you know what? What it costs me to get that property is actually a project cost. And so if you average $2,500 per acquisition, it always varies in different markets, it's just the average $2,500, you're closing 10 rehabs a month, let's just say you are, that's $25,000 that you're putting back in your bank account for marketing. You see how this starts to change your business? No money in projects, net 30 terms with your lenders, and you're putting your marketing back into your bank account. You've just neutralized your marketing expense. Now you start running to a position of power. Now you start to change the game because you're controlling the money. The money is not controlling you. It's the first thing you need to do is get control of the money. And it's just about having the right conversation with you. It really is. I'm a better bet if I'm a better business. Okay? So, little changes. You start to operate from strength and not weakness. So, I'm going to move a little faster here just so I want to get through this and I want to get through the contractor portion of it. Okay, so, hiring contractors, just to run through this real fast. Craigslist, referrals, driving for contractors. Everybody asks, how do you get contractors? You got to turn a lot of dirt to get the gold, right? You got to talk to a lot of people. We're calling people on Craigslist. We're getting referrals. If I see somebody in a parking lot with a beat-up truck, I take a picture of their phone number and I call them. If we're driving through a neighborhood and we see somebody doing some work, I stop and get a business card, driving for contractors and driving for dollars, and we have conversations with them. So what we do when we have the conversations with them is there's a few things we want to do. The first thing we do is we tell them exactly who we are and what we're doing. 50% of the people you talk to, if not more, will disqualify themselves. They don't want to work with flippers. We don't pay. We're crooks. We want too cheap pricing. Don't try to sell anybody who doesn't want to work with you. Then we go into, we need wholesale pricing. We don't want you to get rich. We don't need to get rich. We just need a fair price and make sure that they're on the same page. And if they're on the same page, then we want to see a finished job and a work in progress. And the reason why we want to see a finished job is because I want to point out what is wrong with that job. I don't want to go see what they've done right. And the reason why I want to point out what's wrong with that job is because I want to make sure that their character is in line with what we're teachable and coachable, right? If they make excuses, blame anybody else, I'm not hiring them. If they take responsibility and accountability, there's somebody I'm going to continue to talk to. Does that make sense? I'm looking for character. So I'm looking for the littlest, tiniest flaw, and I'm going, I don't like that, and I'm looking at their reaction. That's very, very important, right? Work in progress. Work in progress is important to see because you want to know if that project is in line with what they're telling you is at. It's amazing. They'll say, oh, yeah, we're going to be done in 3 days. You walk in and there's no way and there's nobody there. Like these, I don't know if they just think we're dumb or we don't know what we're doing, but you can walk in, even as a novice, you can walk into a property and see that things aren't lining up, right, for what they're telling you is supposed to be done. And we work on this thing for 6 months, and I'm like, you're like forever from ever being done. And you're also looking for safety issues, health hazards. You know, are there people on the job? You know, that kind of thing. You're looking for those things. Work in progress tells you a lot about how a contractor runs their business. Are they teachable, coachable? We talked about that. Listen to how they answer the questions. Just take that picture. There you go. Okay. Did you get that picture? All right. There you go. There you go. One more time. Okay, so setting the standard, you are the boss. We have this standards and practices document we do that basically says, you know, work has to be this reasonable standard of quality, straight lines must be straight, blah, blah, blah. This is how we pay you and when we pay you. And change orders. We address change orders in it as well. The change orders have to be priced at the same price they're bid us on. Contractors, how many people realize contractors make their money on change orders? Okay? They'll double or three times the cost on it. So right up front, they have to be equal to what the price would have been in the original bid. And it has to be signed off by us or someone. Period. End of story. I don't care if I said yes and walked away. It has to be signed. Or we're not. So you got to know your value, obviously. You're not looking for a buddy. You're not looking for a friend. You're looking for somebody to do a job. Every time I hire a contractor I like, it always turns out bad for me. It's like the worst thing in the world. So numbers, you're looking for wholesale price. We covered that. You're discussing change orders. Jumping ahead here, I guess. It's important to understand the numbers. Okay, and this, what I mean by this is this. Sometimes the cheapest bid isn't always the best bid. Okay? I said that one time. Sometimes the cheapest bid isn't always the best bid. You got to know when somebody is underbidding your job. If somebody is underbidding your job, you are going to get screwed one way or the other. They're going to change order the hell out of you because they're baiting and switching you. When they don't know what the hell they're doing, they're going to run out of money to spear. Okay? So you got to know that something should cost about, and if it's not somewhere around there, then there's a problem. Yeah. Ask questions. Talk to people. Learn. Pay attention to your project. Sometimes you're going to have to do a project or two and get your butt handed to you to figure it out. I'll be honest with you. This took time to learn. I stood in Home Depot for hours pricing things out. I know every single floor plan to this day of every Home Depot in my area. And I never want to go back again. But I stood there and I learned that this is a business. You want to have a business, right? I can stand up here and tell you that everything is easy and it's all pretty and has sparkles and all that good stuff, but the reality is this is a business, and sometimes business is hard, and sometimes you have to learn things. And so those are things, talk to people, talk to contractors, talk to other rehabbers and stuff in your market, go to Home Depot, talk to some of the people that work there, ask them if this is a reasonable price, and learn. You don't have to know the exact number, you just have to know what it should cost about, so you know if it's too high or too low. Does that make sense? So, okay, a reasonable standard of quality, we hit on that. Looks safe, doesn't it? That wasn't one of my properties, by the way. Yeah. Anybody want to take a shower? It's a real picture. When and how they get paid, I went over that. Just to kind of talk about when and how they get paid. I don't do, hang on, I'm jumping ahead. So I'll talk about that later. What you will and will not tolerate. You are the boss. You have to know your value. You have to set the standard. Okay? You're not there to be their buddy. Okay? That's what I think the biggest mistake we make is we're trying to be nice. We need to let them know, right? You know, they always say it's easier to be mean and then get nice and it is to be nice and get mean. I go in and I just... The really cool thing about me is when I'm excited, I'm this. And when I'm mad, I'm this. Right? I'm almost impossible to read. I screw with people's head because people work with me for the years and they're like, I still can't read you. Which is a benefit. But become that way with the people who work for you so that you don't look overly eager, overly excited or really likable. You're there to make sure that you're managing the project. Okay. Buy-in materials. I avoid buy-in materials. Who here buys materials and who here doesn't? I don't buy materials. And my logic is a little story. I'll tell you a little story real quick. Way back when, they shake my hand 2 weeks, $20,000, I'd be 3 months later, 4 months later, I'd be $40,000, $50,000. And I was getting taken advantage of a lot. This is 2003, 2004, and 2005. And I had a contractor who I caught taking advantage of me, and he said, you know what, I'll make it up to you. I'll paint your house. You're going to move into. For free, you just buy the material. And I said, okay. Right? And so I went in, this is not knowing how things should be. After I rehabbed, I don't know how many properties. And I'm standing with them, and I'm standing in the living room, and they said, okay, living room, 2 5-gallons. Kitchen, 1 5-gallon. Hallway, 1 5-gallon. Master bedroom, 1 5-gallon. Each bedroom, 1 5-gallon. The 2 bathrooms, 1 5-gallon. And I'm writing this down, and I'm like, okay. And I go to Sherman Williams, and I set the paper down, and the guy looks at me, and he goes, how many houses are you painting? And I was like, one. why? And he's like, because you're painting, you got to buy enough paint to build to paint a 5,000 square foot mansion. I mean, it was like, and so it was the realization that most people, I mean, you just can't always trust people, right? I mean, so, but I don't buy materials because I don't want to have a situation where there's leftover materials and I got to store it somewhere. I don't want to have a situation where there's leftover materials and they take it to another job and they make money. I don't want to have a situation where I feel like you're stealing from me. I don't want that. I want to have a good working relationship with you. So when you bid me for material and labor included. And you can do it labor and material if that's how it's best for your business. But for me, and the trust factor in me wanting to be okay and me not wanting my team running to get materials all the time. How many of you have had a contractor blame you with the job being late because you didn't have materials there on time? Right? That solves that problem because you're responsible for getting materials. So if it's late, it's your fault. How many people have run crazy while trying to get materials to a contractor on time? I don't. That's a full-time job when you're rehabbing at a high volume. So we don't buy materials. We pick them. Yeah. And I have a whole thing where we have the SKUs and everything, and we just give it to them. And it's first choice, second choice, third choice. And the other thing, especially right now in this market, standardizing your rehabs to where they're pretty much always the same in some fashion will help you, especially if you're doing high volume. So the different ways to bid, right? Some people will bid by the room. Some people will bid labor only. Some people will bid material and labor, 30 grand for material and labor all included. Some people will bid 30 grand labor only, right? And then there's the way we do it, which is line item, okay? If a contractor walks through a house with me and says, 2,000 for this room, 3,000 for that room, blah, 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 that's not what I want. They go in and they get handed a bid and they say $30,000 for everything. That's not what I want. How many of you had a situation where you know you talked to the contractor about something being in the bid and they said $20,000 all in and then you get to the end and you're like, well, this, what about this? Well, that wasn't in the bid. How do you prove it wasn't? Or they come to you and they say, well, there's 10, I counted 10 lights, but there's really 12. I need you to pay me for two more. How many times does that happen? How do you check? It's got to be line item. Two vanity lights, 10 this, 8 doors, 2 toilets. I want material and labor, and I want line items. I'm not giving you the job. Because if you come to me, I don't trust anymore. I don't. I've been burned too many times. I'm sorry. I don't trust anymore. You have to earn my trust. And with contractors and employees, you never fully earn it. I've always got the side eye going. And so I want to be able to maintain a good working relationship. And if I'm always questioning you, then you're going to feel like I mean, if your boyfriend or girlfriend's always questioning, like, who's calling, where you been, like, it doesn't create a good relationship, right? So I want to create situations that create a good relationship. Line item bids, very clear. It's not in there. I can check. I believe you. You know what I'm saying? You buy material, you're not storing anything. No, that's material, labor included. And they'll give me the number, right? And that'll be the number there. And so this is a way old bit, but we've actually went through and standardized. Like, we'll sit down with the contractor, you know, a couple of times a year and say, okay, where is the pricing at now? And it will agree to this is what this is going to cost every time. Does that make sense? Okay, so what we want to see is the line item bid, and my logic behind it, I've already shared that with you. Okay, contractors, I don't do deposits. I'm allergic to them. Period, hands down. Who here pays $10,000 or $15,000 or $30,000 up front before a job starts or has done it in the past? Okay. I don't do deposits. In California, check your state laws. In California, it's 10% or $1,000, whichever is the least, is the maximum deposit you can pay. So when a contractor's trying to get $25,000 to start a job, he's breaking the law. But the other thing you do is you set yourself up for a situation where you're going to have a problem. You're going to have contractors cash flowing your jobs, trying to use your money to pay for other jobs. You're going to have a situation where they're going to get maybe halfway through or 80% of where they're supposed to be and then need the money for payroll. Like, it just creates all these situations. We don't do it. So I don't do it because I want to keep honest people honest. Everything I do is because I want to keep honest people honest. No matter how good you are, if you wake up in the morning and you've got a $30,000 check for somebody and your mortgage is past due and your wife is yelling at you or your husband's yelling at you and your kids need to eat, it's that customer's money or it's my family, right? Doesn't matter how good you are. Survival mode's a funny thing. Go ahead. I'll tell you how to do it. I'll tell you what I'm doing. You're making assumptions, and I'm not there yet. Okay. So we dictate how we pay, when we pay. We don't do draws. We only pay for work completed, and it's important to make sure that you are clear on what you can and can't do when you pay them. Okay. In other words, this is a working relationship. They got to be able to set expectations on when they can buy materials, pay their people, something like that. So you got to be able to tell them, I can pay you weekly, I can pay you bi-weekly, my lender draws monthly. That has to be clear communication, right? Don't tell them that you can do something that you can't. Because again, what they care about is whether or not they're going to get paid, and what you care about is whether or not your job's going to get done. You have to create a situation that's win-win for both people. Okay? So clearly communicate when you can pay. Okay, so we don't do draws. We make them buy materials. So what we do is we have an invoicing system where they pre-invoice us. Okay, a draw is basically it's the construction lingo for you do a draw. Like I'm going to do a $10,000 deposit, and then when I hit $10,000 worth of work, I'm going to draw another $10,000, say it's a $30,000 job. I'm going to draw another $10,000, and then at the end of the job, I'll draw the last $10,000. Does that make sense? So we have them pre-invoice this work they're going to complete. Okay, so say, what's the first thing you're going to do on a job? You're going to demo. Why do you need my money to buy materials? You're going to demo. Okay? So you invoice me for the next week, and you turn that in by Friday. You tell me what you're going to finish the next week, and then by that following Friday, when that work is done, you get a check. You get your money. Okay? You care about getting paid, I care about getting paid. So, what that does for me is Monday morning, I have somebody come into the office, they cut all the checks for the week, okay, they make reports, they submit to our lenders. A lot of our lenders will draw our rehab budget. I'm fine with that, I don't want the money in my bank account. So we submit to them, whether we're drawing from them or we have their money, we still submit to them, we tell them what we finished for that week, and then they give us the money either Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, and then on Friday we pay the contractor. You notice what that does? The controls. The contractor sets a goal. They set a timeline. They're telling us what they're going to finish and when they're going to finish it. We know what our weekly liabilities are. It's not a surprise. I'm not running back to the office trying to cut a check because I got caught out of nowhere. My money's in the bank before I pay it out. What does that do for cash flow? Solves cash flow. Okay? You see what I'm creating here? Okay? So the contractor's not waiting for their money. And in some cases, if I've worked with you enough and I know that you need a little extra, you need to bill me a little extra because you need to buy materials, I'm okay with that. $1,000 extra because you need to buy materials is not $10,000 rolling the dice. Is that fair? So, before I jump ahead, because that's actually close to my last slide. Does that make sense, everybody? Any question? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so make sure they submit, they pre-invoice us, telling us what they're going to finish for the next week. They plan to finish. They submit their check on Friday. Our team does cut the check on Mondays. And what they do is they basically do a report to the lender that this is what we're paying out this week. Whether we're drawing from you or we have your money, we're still telling you what we're paying out for the week. And then if we're drawing from you, then you're giving us a check either Wednesday or Thursday. And then, yes, we paid a contractor on Friday. Now, one of the questions is going to be, what happens if they don't finish the work? Is that your question? Okay. If I've worked with you on a regular basis and you didn't finish painting the exterior because it rained that week, and I know you're going to show up on Saturday and Sunday and finish it, then I'm going to give you your check. If you're somebody I haven't worked with regularly, then I'm going to cut the check for the difference. I'm going to recut it for the difference, or I'm not going to pay you depending on how big the difference is. Okay? And it's a check and balance. The funny thing about systems, what systems are, when you create situations like this in your business, is they're lines in the sand. Right? You're saying that this is my boundary. What that does is it gives you the option of changing that boundary. It gives you the option, right? But gotta manage. manage the managers. It's an on-site visit. Somebody's got to go see that project. That's one of the reasons why I won't rehab out of state. I just won't. It's how you frame it, and the answer is probably, I can't right off the top of my head remember it, but I just sit down and say, this, you're giving me 100% of project costs, and this is what it costs me to acquire that property. Acquisitions fee, finder's fee. Yeah, and that's a legitimate cost. And somebody will say, well, you're borrowing it, so you're paying interest on it. Yeah, I'm going to pay a few pennies to be able to sleep at night. That's worth it. It depends on the lender. I have 2008 PTSD, and I don't want to hold people's money that I'm not using. Right? That's just how I operate. It doesn't mean it's wrong. I borrow secure, period. I borrow for the project and pay back for the project. I don't borrow just to have money in the bank. I will borrow from the lender, but a lot of times the lender will hold it and they'll give it to me weekly as I use it. And I'm okay with that. You got to make sure you work with a lender that's going to do that. But I'm actually okay with that. And I don't work with lenders that we need to check it before they give me the money. That's a nightmare. That is an absolute nightmare. Yeah, I'll do 10%. When I talk to them, though, when I sit down with them, I say, what are you accustomed to getting? What would you like to see? And sometimes they'll say 6 or 5 or 4. And sometimes they'll say 16, and I'll say, I won't do 16. I always ask the question instead of telling them what I'm going to pay because it puts me in a position of power. Everything I do, how I do every single conversation is from a position of being able to say yes or no. Okay, you got to manage the managers, keep honest people honest, and you want to catch issues before they become uncatchable. In other words, if something is going to cost more money to rip out after 5 steps later, you want to make sure you catch it before the 5 steps later. You want to be able to see, too, like, did the contractor install the cabinets before they textured and painted the wall? Because I've had that happen, right? There's a certain order things should happen. You don't want to, somebody tell me earlier that, you know, somebody sheetrocked the ceiling before the electrical stuff. You don't want to have that happen because it just costs you more money to undo it. So, real quick here, so I've got a few minutes. A few of the biggest lessons I learned from losing it all, and I'll be here all day if anybody wants to catch me and ask me questions. Biggest lessons from losing it all. So know your why. Each and every day, this is why I do what I do. Okay? Know your why. Be purposeful about it. Know what you're fighting for. You have a clear vision of what you're fighting for, and you become comfortable to fight for it. Take action each and one more thing. The one in the middle, actually, he's 17 years old. He's a senior in high school. He's already got 2 contracts under his belt. His acquisition's working. The other kid right there, it's an earlier picture. He's 16 years old. He's got 270,000 followers on TikTok. Doesn't want to do what dad does, but I'm fine with it. That's a whole other story. Take action each and every day, no matter what happened the day before, no matter how hard you got beat the day before. Get up and do it work. It's important. You can't quit on yourself. Don't stay on an island. Find a network. Find your circle. Have people around you who've got your back. Too many of us do this thing alone, in the dark, in a room. Don't surround ourselves with people that are fighting the same battle. Find your group, find your posse, find your passion, find your people. And then act with purpose, be decisive, and move on opportunity that is right in front of you. Okay? All right. Did you get that? Okay. If you did, can you go and like and subscribe Flip Talk Podcast and share it with as many people as you can? My mission is legacy. I want to impact as many lives as possible. Okay? And last but not least, if you want to get a hold of me, my phone number, my email, my real phone number is on there. So that's how you find me. Okay? That's what I got, so I'll leave that up there. It's not working? Okay. If it's not working for you, my phone number, I'm going to give it out. 559-473-3242. You can actually walk up here and see it all. So it's actually right there. 559-473-3242. email is don@fliptalk.com. Yeah. You develop just like you develop your team, to be honest with you. It's a work in progress. It doesn't happen overnight. If you have contractors, like I try to find people who are a year or two in the business, don't have a huge business book, but still do good quality, and I help them build their business with me. And as long as they're teachable and coachable, then that's what I do. And you'll always, even people you work with for years, will start to try to pressure people on you, or they'll get an attitude, and we just stop giving them work for a minute. And we'll circle back to them and say, okay, you're ready to work with us again. So, but it's a juggling act. I'm not going to lie and pretend it's easy for me every single day or my team, but it just is how you look at this and how you approach this that makes it different from everybody else. It makes it easier most of the time. Does that make sense? A California president. Yeah. I have 6 VAs that do lead management and data management for me. I have 2 project managers, 3 acquisitions people, a TC, and a dispo. Yeah. And it's changed the years, yeah. I let them have discounts, points, all of that. Like, none of that matters to me. So people will say, well, if I buy all the materials and I get all the points, that's great, but you also have all the headaches. So the contractor can have the points. If they want to go to the bid room and get all the discounts, I don't care. My price is my price. If he goes and saves money and increases his profit, good for him. I'm getting what I want. Why do I care about whether or not he gets a better deal? Right. Because I set my budget, and I know what my budget is, and I'm doing what I need to do, and that's all that matters to me. And if they get a deal, they find it on sale, they get it off of eBay, like, I don't care. As long as my work is done, and I can sleep. Yeah. I'm actually more cautious now. Yeah, so as the market slows down, I'll look for opportunities and my business will adapt to whatever those opportunities are. Do them differently, maybe. Wholesale more, make sure there's more cushion there, you know, try to buy deeper, change your model. It just depends on what the market's doing, yeah. If you just look right here, the information's right there. Is it? Let me see. Oh, wow. Okay. Maybe. Thank you. Well, if you guys want to walk up here, my information is right there on the screen. Like, you guys can take it down. If the QR isn't working. Driving for contractors, like I said, it's turning dirt. You got to turn a lot of dirt to get the gold, man. You know, Craigslist referrals, driving neighborhoods, taking pictures of phone numbers on trucks and parking lots, like everything. And we just talk to as many people as we can constantly. Let's see if this thing lets me log in. Okay, there it goes. Oh, that's why. All right. I won't hire them if they won't pay for the materials, yeah. No problem, thank you. I'm not going to worry about it. No, it wasn't, yeah.
I learned the hard way.
Yeah.
So I'm a very small guy.